Welcome. This is the UX Design Cast podcast series, and my name is Carl Vredenberg. This is episode number 36, and it is a design leader interview format today. The company that we'll be looking at is the New York Times, and the design leader that we're going to be talking with today is Alex Wright, who is the Director of User Experience and Product Research. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, Carl. Thanks for having me.
Well, glad to have you on. I've been really looking forward to having a discussion with you on the overall topic, a whole variety of topics actually related to user experience design and the New York Times and also in general as well. So I know that you have had a number of sort of important jobs and positions at various companies over your career. We overlapped at one point, and that's how we got to know one another. And I wonder if you could just outline for everybody listening, just by way of introduction, what kinds of things you have done, where, and perhaps even just starting with, you know, what got you started in this overall field?
Sure. Yeah, so I've had what I guess you might call a kind of accidental career path. I think like a lot of people who got into the web, you know, a few years ago, I came from somewhere else. And for me, that was I had worked for several years as a journalist and as a librarian. I worked in academic libraries for about 6 years. And then I was also freelancing for a bunch of magazines in the Boston area. And it was around 1993, I think, I was working in the science library at Harvard, and the some of the kids in the physics lab put together this little demo that they held in one of the labs there where they showed this new thing called Mosaic. And I went down there and I saw that and I thought, oh, that looks pretty cool. And so I went and talked to them afterwards, and they convinced one of them to come help set up Mosaic on my machine, and we had to set up the TCP/IP stack and get everything pulled together. But then I started just sort of futzing around with it, and eventually I learned a little HTML and hacked together kind of a library web page. And you know, back in that era, you know, it was a time when, you know, there weren't a lot of people doing this stuff, and somehow through some you know, chain of events, I ended up getting a job at IBM as the managing editor of the IBM.com website. And at the time, I think they were looking for somebody who had some editorial skills, but also knew a little bit of HTML. I mean, this was back in there when you, a typical web team was maybe one or two people, you know. And at the time, you know, IBM wasn't completely sure about this whole web thing. And so they hired, you know, they were hiring contractors to kind of put this together. They thought they'd give it about 6 months and see if the, you know, if the web went anywhere. And, fortunately for me, it did. And I ended up staying on at IBM for about 5 years, which is where I met you and quite a number of folks from the human factors community at IBM, where I really, you know, learned a lot about the sort of heritage of user-centered design and trying to and had a kind of on-the-job education in things like, you know, usability testing and, you know, how to design with the user in mind and how to develop some, you know, some processes and some methodologies around that. And so over the, as the web sort of evolved and as IBM started to embrace it, you know, we the team grew, and eventually I ended up managing what came to be called the user experience team, which was a team of designers and usability analysts, as well as writers and editors. You know, we basically went through several big iterations of the IBM.com website. We were managing both the corporate site and trying to maintain design standards for the company as a whole, which at the time, and I think it still is, a pretty distributed web presence with a lot of different people in different parts of the organization involved in publishing things on the web. And so anyway, so I did that for about 5 years, and then I got sort of swept up in the whole dot-com fever in the late 90s and ended up moving out to San Francisco, where I stayed for about 7 years. And I worked for a little web agency out there called Phoenix Pop that is long gone by now. But that was a great experience, very different kind of professional life out there, but a great bunch of people, and it was much, we worked exclusively with startups, which seemed like a great idea in 1999 or so. And you know, we were working with you know, portfolio of startup companies, and we were sort of taking equity in them, and you know, everything was looking rosy until about April of 2000, when suddenly, you know, all that funny money went away. Things changed rather, you know, dramatically, kind of seemingly overnight. And at that point, you know, like a lot of people, it about that time I ended up going into more of a consulting mode, and that actually ended up working out pretty well. I had the chance to work with several companies out there. I did quite a bit of work with Macromedia and with Sun Microsystems and Yahoo and a few startups and some other companies out there, AOL and I did some work with the Long Now Foundation. And so I became kind of an itinerant user experience consultant for several years, which I enjoyed. And then I took a little bit of time off a few years ago to write a book. So I took about a 1 year sort of sabbatical and wrote my book. And then it was time to get a day job again. And this opportunity at the New York Times came up. So I started here back in 2007.
Now, the book you mentioned has the title, I see, of GLUT, Mastering Information Through the Ages. I don't know if you want to just say a few words about that, Alex.
Sure. Yeah. So I got very interested in the whole topic of how people have managed and organized information over the years. And having come from a library science background and suddenly, you know, landing in this sort of brave new world of the web, I felt like there was something missing from the dialogue about the internet and its sort of effects on the distribution of information. And I felt like what was missing was any kind of historical perspective. I feel like there's something about the dynamics surrounding the computer industry that tend to encourage sort of a forward orientation. I feel like there's always this sort of subtle bias towards the future. And I think that's somewhat driven by the nature of computers, which are very kind of linear machines, but also the computer industry has a vested interest in planned obsolescence and in always trying to keep people thinking about the next thing. And I think the result is that we tend to sort of discount the past or to just not think about it. And I felt like there was, you know, a lot of the sort of hyperbole and rhetoric that was floating around in the 90s was, you know, in the immediate sort of wake of the web really coming into prominence, there was this sense that, you know, everything was, you know, dramatically changed and things would never be the same again. And this was this, you know, revolutionary disruption on the order of Gutenberg. And all those things may well be true, but I felt like there was some value in trying to look back and see, were there other periods in human history where, you know, other sorts of disruptive information technologies have come along and changed the way that people distribute information and communicate with each other. And I felt like there was some value in going back and seeing if there were any parallels there. And so I wrote this book, which is really all about, you know, the book basically, it's all about the world that sort of led up to the web in some sense. I try to look at the sort of history of different information technologies at different points in human history, going back to early pre-literate societies and looking at how they used different forms of symbolic communication as a kind of rudimentary information technology, then looking at the early origins of writing and at the technologies of writing and the institutions that grew up around this new technology of writing, and looking at how that changed there's sort of this relationship between information technology and social change that seems to percolate whenever one of these new technologies arises. And then looking, you know, a little bit further down the line, I look at the Gutenberg Revolution and then at the industrialization of the printing press in the 19th century, which I think is actually a very instructive parallel to what we're going through today in terms of looking at the sort of massive rapid change in the volume of published information taking shape in the wake of a new technology. So.
And now you're actually living all of that by the role you currently have at the New York Times, pushing out a lot of information in a variety of different forms. So a rather interesting path in getting to your new role. Maybe you can tell us a little about your new role. And I think everybody's heard of the New York Times, maybe a little bit more about, you know, how that is actually structured and the place you actually work.
Sure. Yeah, sure. So it's certainly been an interesting time to be in the newspaper business the last couple of years. There's, you know, we really are living in the middle through a pretty convulsive change in the economics of news publishing right now. It's something that we, like a lot of other organizations, are trying to make sense of and figure out how to move forward in the midst of, you know, it's been a pretty challenging, especially last year, a pretty challenging period. My role at the Times is I'm primarily involved in user research. And when I first started here, I actually joined the design team, and I still work very closely with the design team. And I was working as a primarily as an information architect, and was involved in developing, working with the product teams and the technologists to develop prototypes for some new products that we were working on. So, for example, I worked on the new iPhone application that was launched. I guess it's been out for about a year and a half now, and several other new products that are out there now. I did some work on some of our news sections and on the real estate section and a few other initiatives like Times People, which is our social sort of social network sharing utility on the site. So I did a lot of that sort of, you know, IA prototyping kind of work. And then this new role opened up about a little over a year ago, where the Times felt like they needed to put a little more emphasis on research as part of the design process. And so I moved into a role where now I manage a small team of researchers. And primarily what we do is design research. And we actually, one interesting aspect of this job is we work on both the web and the print side. So we research how people interact with the Times, you know, both on the website and in the newspaper, and also on mobile devices and other emerging platforms like the Kindle and whatever else may come along. And so really what we're trying to do is develop a picture of our customers and trying to understand how they interact with us on different platforms. And one interesting thing we've learned is that many of our customers interact with us in multiple ways. A lot of our print readers are also fairly heavy web users. We did a recent study that found that our print subscribers, the average print subscriber follows the New York Times on something like 2.5 different platforms, which is kind of interesting. It's like the old Honda's old tagline of a Honda in every garage, or two Hondas in every garage or whatever. We're trying to understand that, what are the behavior patterns, what are the attitudes towards the Times, and how does that manifest in different platforms? And so we do a lot of qualitative research. We do a lot of interviewing and some light ethnographic kinds of research where we go out and do field studies with people. We also do a fair amount of usability testing whenever we're launching new products or redesigning part of the site. And we do we also do some quantitative research. We work very closely with our analytics team to try to discover patterns in the numbers that come to us from the log files, and try to understand, are there interesting are there hypotheses we can develop about how people relate to us online based on looking at some of those patterns. We also do a fair amount of A/B testing, where we'll try out different variations of a design and release a new design to a subset of our population, and then look at different performance metrics and see if one design is working better than the other. And probably the most recent thing we've done in the last few months is we just launched an online community of users called the New York Times Insight Lab, which is a community of now about 4,000 readers who've opted in to act as kind of an advisory panel and to give us feedback on an ongoing basis about their experiences with the Times. And we can turn to them to do fairly straightforward things like online surveys, but we can also invite them into moderated discussions about particular aspects of the site. We can do certain kinds of remote usability testing. We can do things like online card sorting exercises. But what's nice about it is it gives us a way to kind of bridge quantitative research into qualitative research, and to do it with a fairly loyal, committed group of users over time. So we're still exploring how best to use this community, but it's been a very interesting process so far. So
it's quite extensive, you know, work that you do that I'm sure a lot of people don't realize that's what goes into the design of your products. But so you're really the insight engine, you know, for the Times, in terms of really understanding the customers, the users, where they're going and the like. What kinds of actions come from the work that you do? I talked about a whole variety of things, and some insights, like the fact that there are various touch points that many of your customers have with your products and different platforms and the like. What kinds of, without getting into anything confidential, what kinds of design actions come from some of those insights that you mentioned?
Sure. So now you're asking me to justify my existence, right? So, I think I would like to think that we do have an impact, and we do. I mean, we work pretty closely with the product teams that are responsible for the individual sections, and often we'll get involved in doing, because the Times website has been around for a while, we'll often start with doing a kind of baseline assessment of a particular part of the site, which might involve bringing users in to evaluate, you know, how are things working now, or even in some cases doing a survey, trying to identify, you know, at a high level, what are some of the user, what are the characteristics of the users of this or that section, and can we take that into account? So for a couple of specific examples, we're in the process of working with the folks who maintain our business section right now, and we have a new design that hasn't quite launched yet, but it's getting there, where we discovered something that we've heard pretty consistently about how users feel about the site, which is they feel like there's a lot of information there. which there is. I mean, we publish hundreds of articles every week. It's a lot to digest. And one of the challenges that we're constantly grappling with is trying to give people the breadth of what we have without overwhelming them. And we worked with the team to try to identify some editorial goals as well as some business goals for the design. And we felt that after having done some initial exploratory testing with users, that there was a feeling that there was sort of too much information and it wasn't as well categorized as it could be. And so we went through a process of trying to prioritize the editorial elements on the site based on user feedback and based on the business goals. And we were able to, I think, pretty dramatically reduce the clutter on the page and to try to come up with a more focused design that really was oriented around three particular kinds of information. So, for example, insight and analysis is something that our business section is very good at. They spend a lot of, there are a lot of sites where you can get sort of breaking business news or stock quotes. You know, the Times is sort of one of its strong suits is really publishing more thoughtful analytical pieces where we really have people think a little more deeply about what's going on in the news. And they felt like that wasn't really coming across to people as well as it could, and a lot of readers felt like that was one of the more valuable things that we provided. So we wanted to make that a little more front and center in the design. And so we have a new design in the works that really is focused around that sort of prioritization of things. Another example, one of the challenges we have with the site is, unlike a lot of more traditional software applications or even a lot of websites that are more maybe commerce oriented, we are not one of these sites that's just in the business of converting users or trying to speed people into the checkout process. Mm-hmm. The goals that we're trying to manage are somewhat complex. On the one hand, we know that most of our readers who come to the site are there for a very simple purpose, which is just generally to read something that interests them. And, they're not really there to complete that's often as much of a task as they really have in mind, but from an internal point of view, there are things we would like people to do, like go read other articles or sign up for a newsletter or maybe even subscribe to the newspaper. And then, of course, we have the advertising aspect of things, which is, to a large extent how we pay the bills. And so there's a tricky balancing act there. And it's one of the challenges is trying to sort of prioritize those goals. So you have editorial goals, you have user goals, and then you have business goals. And those things are not, always completely in alignment, and so it's a bit of a you have to kind of negotiate your way through that sometimes. So it presents an interesting challenge from a research point of view to figure out what aspect of things you're trying to understand and how can you help find a kind of a middle path that helps users enjoy the experience of reading while at the same time helping the business do what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. And those three goals for the paper might also be, somewhat different, I would imagine, for the other platforms that your information is provided in as well. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. And, it's much more straightforward. There are some kinds of research we do that are much more straightforward. For example, we did a big design project with our real estate section where, in that case, it's much more of a clear-cut sort of traditional, user-centered design kind of scenario where there's very clear user objectives that you can measure there, like trying to give people a very efficient tool for searching real estate listings. And it's a case where the user goal and the business goal actually aligns pretty well, and the users are interested in finding properties that match their criteria, and the business is interested in selling ads to brokers and homeowners who are interested in finding that market. And so we were able to do some very, I think, very effective user testing to try to optimize that process. And we've gone through three or four rounds of testing. It's a very iterative process where I think each time we're getting it a little better. We've also done some work with, for example, the home delivery subscription aspect of things, where that's a very clear sort of conversion path kind of scenario. So we were able to do A/B testing and this sort of thing to figure out how could we optimize that experience for people. But for other things, when you're in the more sort of the editorial space, it's the goals get a little bit more complicated. So that's something we're constantly just sort of wrestling with.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the platforms that you had mentioned earlier, and one that I absolutely love, it's my primary interface to the content actually these days, is actually through the iPhone app. And I just love this thing. I think the notion of, you know, when it fires up, you get this really neat animation for the New York Times overall logo, and that it does a nice sort of placing into the end of the masthead. And then one of the things that I like about it as well, you talked about sort of the challenges of trying to deal with too much information. And one of the things about the iPhone app is actually that it does that for you. So you have actually a running list of the news coming in. You also have a really neat feature of the most popular stories and the like, and then also the integration with Twitter and Facebook and being able to send things through email. I think the integration, quite frankly, and the way that it actually is carried out is stellar. I think it's among, you know, the best apps that I use. So hats off to you for that.
Oh, thank you.
And I know you were also, you know, directly involved in that project. I wonder if you could just describe as an example of what might have gone into, you know, that design. What kinds of things did you need to do? How did that relate to, you know, the rest of the paper as a particular area of focus?
Well, what I would like to tell you is that we did a rigorous user-centered design process, and we spent a lot of time with users modeling their behavior and, you know, iterated it and prototyped it and tested it in advance and did it right. But the ugly truth is that we designed the first version of this app in about less than 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that was that we had an opportunity to be part of the launch of the App Store with Apple. And we didn't want to pass that up. And so we were basically, it was kind of a scramble. And we designed it in-house, and then we brought in some outside resources who had some skills in developing iPhone applications, which were hard to find before the iPhone App Store launched, because very few people were really doing this stuff. Mm-hmm. But we were able to, basically, it was kind of a fire drill, but in a way that worked to our advantage because it helped us keep it simple. And we decided to basically focus on just what we considered to be the most essential interactions, which are getting a simple list of stories and being able to read that read the stories in a way that projected the Times identity, our brand, which is very wrapped up with our typography to some extent, and just keeping it as simple as possible. And I think we were able to do that. Unfortunately, because we did have such a short runway to launch, the first version of the app was pretty buggy. Performance was not where we wanted it to be, and the first few iterations of this app were had some problems. But I think it's gotten a lot better since then. Since we launched that first sort of buggy version of the app, we've done a lot of follow-on user research where we've brought people in. We've had some conversations. We've spent a lot of time monitoring the feedback that we get by email, and we've really evolved the design quite a bit. So, for example, you mentioned the Twitter and Facebook integration. That was really as a result of feedback that we started to get from users, and which have another version of the app that will be coming out sometime in the next few months, I think, where we have made some additional refinements. But I think what works well about it is, and I think where just the form factor of the iPhone, you know, works well, is it's just it calls out for a simple app, and we were able to, I think in this case, strike a pretty good balance between, you know, really focusing on creating a really nice, elegant reading experience, but still making sure that, you know, that there's a business behind it. And so it does have advertising, and that, you know, I think generally works pretty well once you know, there's an occasional sort of takeover ad in there, but I think it's not too disruptive. So I think that's been, generally, I think people have been pretty pleased with it. It's been more successful than we expected. I think it's gotten 2 million downloads so far or something.
The transition, I think, or the migration, or the going from the earliest versions to the more recent versions of apps all across the App Store have been pretty significant. I found that, you know, apps that have gone through sort of two or three revs now have interaction styles that are phenomenal. I think everybody was in, at least the apps that have been out there for a while, mm-hmm. went through that exact sort of experience that you went through, saying you just got to get something up there. Not only had they not designed and developed these before, not a lot of people had even had that much experience, you know, using them, even though I guess the phone had been out for a year or so, you know, before that. So it's
yeah, I think you're right. I think the first crop of iPhone apps, there were a lot of buggy apps out there, but I think the people that really stuck with it and iterated through it, I think got you know, they've gotten a lot better over time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of them are just amazing.
And it's such a small form factor, but at the same time, there are new, I think, UI design patterns forming that aren't necessarily at a, you know, based on sort of the base capability, but doing some really novel things. You introduced the work at the Times on the challenge that traditional media are going through, this whole notion of a transformation due to a whole bunch of different factors. But how do you see, you know, the work that you're doing, the user experience and product research that's in your title, you know, what kinds of things do you think will be key or perhaps are key to really driving and helping in the transformation from going from the old style to being directly relevant and also being, you know, successful business-wise with regard to overall design?
Well, I think the big challenge for companies like the Times that are, you know, in a way, you know, the Times is kind of a legacy company in some ways. I mean, we're actually a big manufacturing company. We publish, a product that's physically manufactured every day. You know, I've been out to the printing plant in Queens. It's an amazing operation. It's state of the art. There's a big factory floor and people running around with like robotic forklifts. And, you know, it's easy to lose sight, you know, when you sort of spend all your day staring at a web browser, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that, you know, you work for a company that actually makes things, puts them on shelves every day, you know. And I think the challenge for a lot of companies and that have been around for a while is that the economics of the web and the kinds of relationships that you develop with your customers are fundamentally being renegotiated. And so we are transitioning from being this company that, you know, in many ways was predicated on a pretty traditional industrial model where you have, you know, a company that manufactures a product for a mass market. Right, and so you have people inside the building that are just shaping that product, putting it out every day, sending it through, you know, a manufacturing chain through a distribution network that gets out on the shelves, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a one-way communication to some extent, right? And you know, yes, people could write a letter to the editor, but it's a really very different kind of dynamic to what you see on the web, where really the customer is in charge of the experience. Mm-hmm. Right? It's no longer the case that, you know, for somebody interacting with the Times online, that, you know, the particular presentation of news that we have in mind is that there's no guarantee that that's the experience that the user is going to encounter. So we might, you know, for example, lay out our homepage in a certain way, but the fact is a vast percentage of our traffic now comes through other doorways. So people come in through people, you know, are recommending articles on Facebook. They're putting them on their Twitter feeds. They're following, you know, RSS. They're coming in through Google. You know, the user is now really in charge of the experience, and the user is curating that experience for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it introduces a very interesting tension where we have this sort of traditional editorial process where we spend a lot of time, the company, you know, the organization spends a lot of time thinking about, you know, how to make sense of the world every day and put that into a kind of narrative that has a, you know, particular form in the form of a newspaper. And on the web, that all gets renegotiated. And so it becomes more important to understand the user who is, you know, the user behaviors that are really shaping the way people consume the news. And we have to start adapting to that and to make sure that we're creating an experience that is flexible and lets people do what they want to do while at the same time giving them what people also expect of the Times, which is to some extent, you know, an editorially curated view of the world. And mm-hmm. so we're constantly trying to explore that balance, you know, between to what extent do people want us to just tell them how it is and to what extent do people want to figure it out for themselves. One of the really interesting challenges we're dealing with on the web is how can we approximate the kind of serendipity that people find in the newspaper? I think one of the things that really appeals to people about the newspaper is you pick it up and you start reading and you there's all kinds of elements there's all kinds of opportunities for surprise. You can, you know, start flipping through the paper and get into the art section and, you know, you might be reading about a particular movie review that you think is interesting, but then in the next column there's something about, you know, a dance performance or a restaurant review or a theater review or something that you wouldn't have known you were looking for, but that grabs your eye. On the web, it's much more difficult to create that kind of experience because on the web, people tend to have a little more tunnel vision. They tend to come in, find the article that's interesting to them, and then it's a little hard to dislodge their focus to get them to look at something else. So we're constantly trying to think about, you know, what are some of the ways that we can create opportunities for serendipity, get people more engaged in, you know, in looking more broadly across what we're doing. For example, creating tools for social sharing and collaborative filtering, you know, are potentially very powerful ways of creating opportunities for that kind of serendipity. So that's one area where I think we're, you know, getting out there, talking to users, watching how they interact with us, watching how they interact with us across platforms and across devices, really helps us develop a fuller understanding of the ways that people are interacting with our content and make sure that we can anticipate what they're looking for, what they want to do, and try to support it as best we can. But trying to, you know, really at the end of the day, trying to understand, trying to acknowledge that the user has a much more active voice in the editorial process than they used to, and that goes, you know, stretches into things like increasing prevalence of comments, of both on our website and outside our website, that there's a sort of whole evolving conversation taking shape that we want to be part of, while at the same time maintaining a certain editorial authority, I guess you could say, which I think is to some extent what people expect from us.
And that is a challenge to get right in terms of the actual balance, you know, between.
The challenge is, you know, the risk is that things could, you know, if we just decided that the whole thing is just, you know, going to be one big sort of free-for-all conversation,
right,
with whoever comes to the website, then at some point it just devolves into meaninglessness. Like, I think people do actually expect for an institution like the Times to produce a certain kind of writing, a certain kind of objective, professionally edited, insightful kind of view of things, and that it's that those kinds of efforts can really produce can create a very nice fulcrum for a conversation to take shape around. But when, you know, there's all kinds of interesting questions about how deep do we get ourselves engaged in the broader conversation, and to what extent do we more provide kind of a forum for that to happen.
Some fascinating challenges in terms of media and where it's going in its various formats. I wanted to ask you too, just in terms of the disciplines, the user experience design sort of disciplines, what your thoughts are with regard to trends in that whole area. I mean, there's changes everywhere. What kinds of challenges and what kinds of directions, what kinds of things do you think people that are listening to this podcast that are in those disciplines, what are the kind of things that you see yourself and maybe other colleagues that you work with or collaborate with, maybe thinking in terms of what the challenges are in the future?
Well, I mean, the one that comes to mind is the challenge of designing experiences that can extend across platforms and across, you know, different services and applications. I think increasingly, as you're seeing, you know, more and more a sort of growing layer of data being exposed. At the Times, for example, we recently opened up our API so that now anybody can access our. We have an article API and a bunch of other APIs for people to basically kind of remix our stuff. And it's very interesting to see what people are doing with that. But one I think where that points to a world where, you know, people are creating their own kinds of interfaces to data that's coming from somewhere else. And as the next generation of mobile devices take shape, you're going to see a lot of, I think, a lot more opportunities for interesting kinds of integration at a data layer and applications that are able to share data with each other and to create new kinds of experiences that may pull together data and services from multiple different sources. For example, we have recently been working on a project to geotag a lot of our articles so that we could actually create kind of an integrated, you can actually now see on Google Earth a view of Google Earth that has New York Times content plotted geographically, right? So, you know, now anybody else could now build another layer on top of that, right? So the experience has become much more distributed, and it's no longer a question of just designing the widgets that go inside the rectangular window on the screen. You really have to think about the experience in a different way, and of experiences that you may not completely control, but that you have to identify, you know, to what extent you can provide the right kinds of data at the right time, and how can you expose your services in an intelligent way that lets other people create value on top of that. And beyond that, I think, you know, we also, even within the content that we do control, we have to think about how do we create a seamless experience across devices and across platforms. I think Apple does a very good job of this. If you look at the iTunes experience, it spans, you know, from in my personal case, it spans multiple devices. You know, I have iTunes on my laptop, I have an Apple TV, I have an iPhone, and the experience of the iTunes store and the integration of those services, you know, extends across multiple applications on multiple devices. And yet there's a there's an underlying service there that works pretty well. And I think it's interesting to think about the idea of news as a service, you know, that could feed multiple applications on multiple platforms. And the shape of news is now changing, where it's not just, you know, text articles, but we publish a lot of multimedia and video and things like that. And trying to think through how can we support a sort of changing user model where people really are the particular machine and the particular web browser is starting to give way to a much more fluid kind of interaction that can go across multiple devices at different times of day.
So there's probably two themes that I hear you saying. One is the one that I mentioned in a talk earlier in the week, of talking about sort of opening the aperture of design, you know, not being down at the microscopic level of pixel pushing on websites, but really stepping back and seeing, you know, all the different platforms and individual users across, you know, those various platforms, as well as seeing that, you know, broader experience and even groups of people doing that as well. And the other one that I hear you saying is also to really understand, I think, some of that technology. We're talking about the APIs that are now being made available, the notion of being able to aggregate in a variety of different ways the information to allow users to have certain experiences. Seems like there's a trend at taking a step back, you know, bigger picture thinking, design across a number of different devices and environments, and also a more acute understanding probably of the technologies that are required to create that, you know, experience as well. Does that summarize the kinds of things you were getting at?
Yeah, I think you said it better than I did. So.
Well, related to that, I've been just thinking about the work that you did early on in your career when life was all about creating a website, you know, a single website and navigation to other parts of the website. And it could get bigger, but it was still only a browser that typically only ever appeared on a pretty quite traditional computer screen. And now we're dealing, as you've just been describing, all of these other platforms and forums and the like, and all that, you know, has happened in a relatively short period of time. There are a bunch of people that I know listen to this podcast series that are just starting out. They're considering going in this field. They're, you know, at university at the moment. It's a typical experience, I think, of people that are at the point in their career that you're in now, I think, in terms of in the position that you're in and the kind of experience that you've had, to think back and say, you know, what advice would you have for people who are just starting out? What are the kinds of things that you know now that you wish you knew back then before you started out, so that, you know, to make it somewhat easier for folks starting out? Any advice that you'd give those folks?
Well, you know, it's funny, if I think about that question, I'm actually very glad that I didn't know what I know now then, because I think that, you know, when I was younger and starting out, things were a little more, you know, the whole web was really much more uncharted territory back then. We were all kind of making it up as we went along. And there was that sense of possibility and a willingness to experiment that I think now, as things have matured, the industry's matured, roles have, you know, become more well understood and processed. You know, people are a little, have more, you know, well thought out design processes. I think that's all well and good. And it's led to, I think, a sort of a professionalization of the web and people, you know, don't make the sort of stupid mistakes that they made back then. Things are much more well managed in a lot of ways, but I think that there's something to be said for a certain level of ignorance going into these things.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a danger in becoming too much of an expert too quickly, and I think for some people, especially in a, you know, for people getting into the field now, I think there's a lot of impetus to specialize and to say, okay, I'm going to be a user researcher, or I'm going to be a designer, or I'm going to be a technologist. And what was great about the web in the early days was I think everybody was a generalist. And I think it's actually very important, and I think what will become more important in the years ahead is actually to have people who are able to span disciplines and to move fluidly for, to have designers who really understand technology, researchers who have some level of design sense, and that people don't, that one not try to get too, get too far down the road of being a highly credentialed practitioner in a narrow field. I think what really makes for great experiences are when you really have a kind of multidisciplinary approach to things. And so I guess the advice I would have to anybody starting out is to broaden your skill set early. And because there will be, especially for people coming into maybe more junior roles, there will be a lot of impetus to specialize and to always look for opportunities to stretch out and expand your skill set and try something, maybe try something that's a little scary, but try to broaden yourself. So I think the people that will really succeed in the field going forward are those who really can have a command of more than one discipline and can really think horizontally about problems in a more integrative way and not in a sort of reductionist specialist kind of way.
I couldn't agree more, and very, very well said. And maybe based on your life and experience too, even the notion of staying grounded too in history, just thinking back to your book and the kind of notion of learning and adapting to the current sort of environment that you've been certainly dealing with and learning as you go. You certainly have a really healthy approach to, staying current and staying on top of technologies as they grow, and then applying everything you've learned to them as well. So I think it's some excellent advice. Okay, Alex, that's great. I wanted to just thank you for the time you spent here. A really fascinating discussion on, yourself, your own career, and also some of the wonderful things that are happening at the Times. I'm sure, like I said earlier, probably surprising to a lot of people what all goes into designing and getting insights into customers to come up with the kinds of products that come out of the New York Times. So I also wanted to just mention the coordinates in terms of getting further information. Obviously, the New York Times online is at nytimes.com. Alex's own blog and site is alexwright.org. You can always get information and show notes about this podcast at uxdesigncast.com. You can also get it on ibm.com/design as well. So with that, I'd like to thank Alex once again. Thanks, Alex, for being part of this.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
And thanks, too, to all of you who have been listening. And we'll talk to you all next time. Bye for now.